Welcome to International Edition, where we take a closer look at stories of the day, social media, and entertainment. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a UN appeal for a humanitarian ceasefire in Yemen.
That has in the past worked. There was a week-long ceasefire that did allow some humanitarian aid.
South Korea reports 5 new cases of MERS. What's trending today online? Political maneuvering on Capitol Hill over trade measures, and a Senegalese-American musician works to bring power to parts of Africa. Coming up right here on The Voice of America. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon today called for Yemen's warring sides to observe a humanitarian ceasefire of at least 2 weeks during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is following the story from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo and joins us on the line. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
Hi. What can you tell us about what the UN official had to say?
Well, he's asking for a ceasefire, and that has in the past worked. There was a week-long ceasefire that did allow some humanitarian aid that was more or less both sides complied with. At this point, though, they're also starting peace talks. So they're hoping that if things calm down a little bit, it might be possible that the peace talks will be more successful. But so far, it's not looking so good.
Well, how are those talks proceeding? Are the two sides meeting and that sort of thing?
Well, the main problem is that Houthis, the rebel group, simply does control much or most of Yemen. They haven't arrived yet. People in Yemen have been telling me for the past couple of weeks that they were hopeful these talks would be much different from the other talks, because the other talks never included the Houthis. And the Houthis have had, now since March 26, a 10-country coalition pounding them with missiles, and they're still stronger than they were before. So without them in the game, it's really hard to believe that peace talks mean anything.
Perhaps you could further describe for us the situation that's going on in Yemen.
Yemen has a population of 22 to 24 million people, I think, and the UN says that 20 million people are in desperate need of humanitarian aid. I talked to people in Yemen say that there is almost no fuel to get anywhere, so or for anything to get anywhere. So even if there is food or water, it can't get to the people who need it the most. Even before this war began, before the Arab Spring, Yemen was having a water crisis and was set to be the country with the first capital to run out of groundwater in the world. There's also a desperate need for medical supplies. People say that there's not nearly enough medical supplies. Yemen's healthcare system was a disaster before the war, so now people are basically without any.
Well, thank you so much, Heather. I appreciate you talking with me today.
Thank you.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Andrew, what do you have to share today?
Well, today is World Meat Free Day. It's an idea.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's the idea being that people, rather than eating meat, will eat vegetables. It's part of the sustainability of not eating meat. The interesting thing about this is that it's hashtag World Meat Free Day that's trending. But this isn't the first time that this topic has come up on social media. The past few, probably past few years, hashtag Meatless Mondays has been a consistently trending topic on Mondays. People taking that day in particular to say, okay, I'm going to abstain from eating meat to make a point about, like I said, sustainability, environmental issues, animal issues, various topics. So today it's become the first annual World Meat Free Day, so they're trying to get everybody involved and kind of coalesce around this one idea.
Does that include everything? I mean, probably beef, but does it include fish and all that, eggs? I mean, it's like the difference between being a vegetarian and a vegan, you know?
Right.
It's very hard to be a vegan.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I think a lot of people are going to seize on this and kind of use it for their own advocacy, I guess you could say. There may be some people who are doing this because of environmental reasons, and they might just not eat meat because they say fish are more sustainable. There might be some people that say we're not going to eat any kind of animal products because of animal rights and things like that. But it'll be interesting to see how that topic kind of shifts as
people are defining it themselves.
Exactly. And right? And case in point with that, we have another trending topic, the Magna Carta. It's the 800th anniversary of the so-called British Bill of Rights, the original British Bill of Rights. And people are talking about the anniversary, but they're using it to talk about their own issues, saying, well, if the Magna Carta were here today, it wouldn't cover this topic or whatnot. So you see a lot of advocacy for people-specific causes and things using that terminology and using that hashtag.
And that, of course, is also tied to our own Constitution here in the United States.
Right. And it's actually tied to a company here in the United States, Google. On the Google, the British version of Google, they have a little Google Doodle up that has King John signing the Magna Carta and putting a stamp on it. So it's a nice little doodle that they have. But it's, it's an interesting little thing that they do. And that's oftentimes when Google creates these doodles to celebrate momentous occasions, those end up being trending topics on social media.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Appreciate you stopping by and sharing everything. And I'll have to go to that Google site.
Absolutely. It's google.co.uk.
Will do. Thanks a lot. That's Andrew, Andrew Palchevsky, our social media expert right here in the studio. The South Korean Health Ministry has announced 5 new cases of Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, MERS, and 2 more deaths, raising the death toll to 16 and the total number of cases to 150 since the outbreak was first detected May 20th. All cases have been traced so far to health facilities. Thousands of people are being quarantined, and the health crisis forced the closure of schools and businesses and cut by tens of thousands the number of tourists in Asia's fourth largest economy. The outbreak has raised alarms in other Asian countries as well. Everybody's looking out. China says it is cutting flights to South Korea, stepping up the monitoring of fever and pneumonia cases, and calling on provincial capitals and port cities to identify specific hospitals to handle suspected MERS cases. However, after reviewing the outbreak for a week, experts from the World Health Organization said there is no evidence to suggest the virus is spreading beyond the South Korean healthcare facilities. Malik Pierce, a virologist at the University of Hong Kong, tells VOA's Victor Beatty South Korean health authorities have in the last 10 days greatly enhanced their control measures.
In concordance with that, we do see the number of new cases declining, and together with that, the enhanced quarantine measures, including no-fly lists that people are being put on, are much, much stronger than what was in place at the early stages of the outbreak. So taking all that together, I think the risks of the virus spilling out of Korea is reduced. It is not zero by any means, but it is reduced. Very intensive monitoring in the next 2 weeks is essential to know and to establish whether the current downward momentum will be maintained.
How would you equate this to the 2002-2003 outbreak of the what was called Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, or SARS, which began in China and killed about 800 people?
It is a related virus, but what we are seeing now is what was happening back in November and December 2002, long before anyone knew anything was going on. And this is looking at it in retrospect, right? After SARS had emerged and spread, and when detailed investigations were done, we realized that in November and December 2002, there were clusters of SARS cases occurring in individual cities in the Guangdong province in southern China. These were emerging and disappearing by themselves without necessarily particular control measures. So it was like sort of minor explosions taking place here and there, which were contained and nobody took much notice of it until in February, when one particular cluster did adapt to more efficient human-to-human transmission, and then it came through Hong Kong, and through Hong Kong it spread worldwide. So we haven't come to that stage of that worldwide spread at the moment. We are at the stage of having these clusters of infection. And mind you, Korea is not the only place where such clusters of infection and outbreaks are taking place. I mean, last year we had 2 quite big clusters of transmission. In fact, each of them bigger than the South Korean outbreak that we are seeing now in Saudi Arabia, one in Jeddah and one in Riyadh. So there are these clusters of MERS transmissions appearing. Up to now, they have been controllable. Because they have been primarily transmitted within hospital settings, and that is crucial because we are not seeing any transmission in the community. Now, as long as it is like that, it is controllable, as it was controlled in Jeddah and in Riyadh. But I think what one cannot take for granted is that at some point that this virus might not change in a way to become more transmissible. Now, it has not done that as far as one can see in South Korea at the moment, but you have to keep in mind that the pot is kind of brewing in the Middle East because the virus is there in the animal host, which primarily is the camel, and it's jumping from time to time to humans and sometimes causing these large outbreaks.
Vera says transmission is usually through coughing or sneezing by an infected person or picked up through touching surfaces such as tabletops. He says the virus can remain viable much longer than the influenza virus, up to 24 hours. There's no known vaccine or treatment for MERS. Its fatality rate has reached nearly 41%. You're tuned to VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Most scientists have linked climate change to increased emissions of greenhouse gases, like carbon dioxide. But now a group of researchers finds that fluctuations in the amount of atmospheric oxygen also influenced climate throughout Earth's history. The scientists say that while currently atmospheric oxygen is around 21%, it has actually fluctuated between 10 and 35% over the past 540 million years. They also say that the amount of oxygen can affect the mass and density of the atmosphere. Whenever there isn't as much oxygen, the atmosphere thins out and becomes less dense. A thinner atmosphere allows for more sunlight to reach the Earth's surface, causing higher temperatures and an increase in precipitation. The researchers admit that while levels of atmospheric oxygen doesn't affect climate as much as heat-trapping CO2, oxygen still plays a major role in regulating climate. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Coming up on International Edition, fighting over trade on Capitol Hill and trying to bring more light to Africa. President Barack Obama is seeking approval from the U.S. Congress for authority to negotiate two huge trade deals, especially one involving several nations in Asia. Congress, Mr. Obama's party in particular, voted down the proposed authority on Friday. It is a big setback for the president for now. The Trade Promotion Authority bill was defeated despite a rare visit by President Obama to Capitol Hill to try to cement support. VOA's Jim Stevenson turned to Senate correspondent Michael Bowman, who has been watching the political maneuvering.
He made this personal effort, this pilgrimage to the Hill, specifically targeting House Democrats, members of his own party. And he wanted those House Democrats to not just vote for trade promotion authority, which allows up or down votes on trade bills. It's called, also known as fast track. Since it facilitates the approval because Congress can't amend the bill. It's simply an up or down vote. But there was also another provision that had to do with retraining American workers who might be impacted by trade, who might lose their jobs as a result of international competition. And this is where it gets confusing because House Democrats voted down that worker assistance, even though they are very much in favor of it. The only reason that they did that is because it proved to be a huge fly in the ointment as far as getting fast track approved. And this is where Congress gets complicated. The Senate passed fast track authority, but they also passed this worker retraining bill. And the way that Congress works, unless the House and the Senate pass identical versions of the bill, it's all for nothing. So House Democrats knew that even though they supported this worker retraining bill, if they voted against it, that it would stop fast track dead in its tracks. And so you had House Democrats meeting with the president, a man that they have, followed into battle on numerous occasions, and a man that they truly revere and admire and are normally on the same page with. But this time they came out of that meeting and voted exactly as the president did not want them to vote. As of right now, fast track is in limbo, which means that two major deals, trade deals, pending trade deals that the Obama administration has been negotiating for years, spanning the Atlantic between the United States and the European Union and the Pacific, a 12-nation trans-Pacific partnership, these are all in limbo because without fast track, there is no real way to get them through Congress intact.
To the casual observer, it's rather interesting to see that President Obama had wide-ranging support from the Republicans on this issue.
Interesting bedfellows.
strange times.
Strange times.
You get strange bedfellows.
On any given day of the week, on any given issue, Republicans line up exactly opposed to President Obama on any issue you could point to, except for this. This is one occasion where the administration is bucking that traditional dogma and saying, look, we are negotiating in a new way. We are going to have all those worker protections. We're going to protect the environment. And we're going to do this in a way that Democrats can feel good about. But the White House is sounding, at least publicly, is sounding optimistic.
And I'm sure there's a lot of backroom negotiations going on so that when it comes around again, perhaps they'll be ready to push it through.
Indeed. And you can imagine all the different pressure groups and interest groups remaining on high alert. I mean, if you are a member of America's labor movement or if you are an environmentalist, you are on high alert right now, reaching out to those House Democrats, telling them to stand strong, not to change their vote. If you're a member of the Chamber of Commerce or you work for the administration, then you are reaching out to them and asking, please, sir or madam, would you mind switching your vote so we can get this done?
One of the many things that keeps Congress interesting for us to watch. And our Senate Superman, Michael Bowman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jim.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
David Byrd and Ray McDonald get together in the studio to bring us today's music feature.
You might know Senegalese-American musician and producer Akon for his song Beautiful, but you didn't know that he is part of a group that wants to bring electric power to 600 million people in Africa. To find out more, Ray McDonald joins me in the studio. Ray, this is a huge undertaking for a pop star, a musician.
Yeah, it is. And it just riveted my attention when I first read about it a couple weeks ago. Now, Akon last released an album in 2008, but he has been busy. He's working on something he calls Lighting Africa. Now, it's a two-year-old project with a billion-dollar credit line. He's working with two partners, and he hopes to provide 600 million Africans with energy from the sun.
Now, its first project, as I understand, is the launch of a solar academy in Mali to train people to work with this initiative?
The Solar Academy in Bamako, Mali, is slated to begin this North American summer. And on Wednesday, Akon told a UN news conference that Lighting Africa has now spread to 14 countries in Saharan and sub-Saharan Africa. So he is really working hard to get this project off the ground.
And providing light to these people or energy to these people not only benefits them by allowing them to have electricity, but also kids can study at home and people can work later. It helps them economically too, right?
Well, Akon says one of the big objectives of Lighting Africa is to take advantage of the continent's human capital. Many parts of Africa get more than 300 days of sun a year, and 70% of the continent's population is under 35. Akon wants to put them to work in building this solar infrastructure and maintaining it.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. We'd love to hear your opinion on this. You can log on to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Voice of America. If you're on Twitter, you can also hit up Ray McDonald at @VOA_music, or Ray, your Twitter handle for your personal account?
Ray on the Hits.
You can also listen for Ray on VOA 1 if you like to listen to music, and you can also hear him do the top 20 and the top 5 countdowns every week. When I see
If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The most important document in British history celebrates its 800th birthday this month, one being marked in our nation, too, for providing a foundation for our government and liberties. In a meadow by the Thames River near London on June 15th, in the year 1215, the English King John sued for peace with a group of rebellious nobles by attaching his royal seal to a Great Charter of Liberties, better known by its title in Latin, the Magna Carta. By most accounts, John was a horrible monarch. He imposed heavy taxes, far higher than those of kings before him. When someone couldn't pay, he took their sons hostage. Those suspected of disloyalty were executed without trial. For interfering with affairs of the church, he was excommunicated. Powerless in the face of open rebellion and anxious to save his throne, John conceded to a list of 63 grievances, and promised from then on to obey the law of the land. Future kings would be bound by the charter as well, he pledged. Many of its provisions are irrelevant today, dealing as they do with such things as feudal laws regarding rents and inheritance. But with its implication that the head of state is subject to the rule of law, and the declaration that all people have a right to a fair trial if accused of a crime, the Magna Carta has become a symbol of liberty, individual freedoms, and the rule of law around the world. Some four centuries later, when English colonists left for the New World, they brought royal charters that established their colonies, each couched with the guarantees of rights and liberties implied by the Magna Carta. And later, when the colonists fought for independence from Britain, they were fighting not so much for rights unknown, but to preserve those rights and liberties now laid out in our Constitution. Magna Carta still forms an important symbol of liberty today. It is the foundation of freedom of the individual against arbitrary authority, and the notion that no one, not even a king, is above the law.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.